Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination on the No Direction Network.
Back with episode 6 of Digital Divination. So last time we actually started our talk concerning the Black Lives Matter protests that were occurring during PaizaCon. As folks might recall, a couple weeks back there was some protests starting, and then since then there's been a ton of protests across the country, and a lot of folks have been coming out in support of these social justice issues, which you know, I think is great. You've seen companies doing it and whatnot, in addition to individuals. And in particular, I noted yesterday that several folks from Paizo participated in what was called a silent march in Seattle, including our very own Ron Lundeen.
That's correct. It was a really powerful thing to do. As far as some of the background that people might not know, the Black Lives Matter organization in Seattle and King County hasn't been behind any of the protests in the past 2 weeks. Their formal position has been, we are in the middle of a global pandemic and protesting doesn't seem responsible to us. But as the movement has gained some momentum, they realize that now is their time to speak, to make sure that they can have something to say. And so what they organized for last Friday was this silent march that went through, you know, 1.8 miles of the city. And that was really smart and really powerful for a couple of reasons. First, it really led to the thought that this is a something that is supposed to be pensive. People should think about how they can be allies, how they can enact change. And a lot of shouting sometimes gets in the way of that. It's also well known that singing and shouting are great ways to spread the coronavirus. And so a silent march through Seattle, when they emphasize really the distancing and the masks, it really, really made me believe that they were behind the, we want people to be safe, but we want people to be able to express their feelings here. That seemed to all come together. It's very powerful march. We ended up right near the front of it. And by the time we got to the park at the end of the march, 1.8 miles away, there were still thousands of people that had not yet left the park at the beginning of the march. And it was dumping rain. It was a miserable day, but there was something like, I've seen numbers like 60,000 people out for this thing.
Right. That's what I saw as well. Over 60,000. Yeah. And you brought your whole family this time.
I did. I brought my kids to the silent march. They had mentioned that this was going to be a kid-friendly activity in that it wasn't intended to be confrontational with the police. In fact, they had police leading, sort of clearing the road ahead of the march. So there are a lot of aspects to Black Lives Matter and defunding the police and so on. But this put the emphasis pretty squarely on, let's be contemplative. Let's be serious about the problems of systemic racial injustice. And there were some speeches at the end of the march, at both the beginning and the end, to sort of pull everything together. That went really well. Afterward, I took my family to Capitol Hill. So I got a 9-year-old and or 2 9-year-olds and a 12-year-old. And then my wife took them with another friend of ours to the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, which is where I'd been protesting the week before. And to see the same area with no barricades and riot police and National Guard was a whole entirely different experience. It was great.
So what did that look like? Because there's been some conflicting news, you know, from various news outlets concerning what's actually going on in the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or CHAZ.
I never felt unsafe having my kids there. I thought, in fact, it was important for them to see this place where there was such tension over the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, my twins are both Black, and it was to see the police station that had been abandoned by the Seattle Police Department, and the plywood and the chain link fencing around it has been decorated with memorials to people that have been killed by the police. There was one very impactful poster that was, here are 25 Black people who've been murdered by the Seattle police. And my son, who is 9, was the one that pointed that out. He's like, who are these people that have been killed? I'm like, well, buddy, let's go look, right? And talk about it and talk about why people would remember it and why this area is a place to be remembering it. But yeah, to those people who say that it's dangerous, I didn't see any of that. We didn't see anybody that was armed or patrolling or even ominous. There were people doing art in the middle of the street, and there was free sort of snacks and water. Friend that I went with said, put it best. He said, I've been to sketchier street fairs. And he also had made sure that he'd packed for the day to come with us. And I'd done the same. We'd packed a lot of snacks and water. That turned out to be the one thing we didn't need to bring, because we were turning, you know, saying no thank you so many times to people who are like, you know, hey, do you need anything to eat? Okay, get you a bottle of water. So it was very friendly, and it was very powerful. It was a great day. It was a great day to really experience a lot of different sides of that movement.
Now, and Paizo as a company has come out with a statement in support of the Black Lives Matter movement as well. And you all actually had the day off from work.
Yeah, for Friday. Yeah, it's not technically connected, but it is practically connected. The Black Lives Matter statement that we had. Corporations make a lot of statements. In my earlier time with companies, you know, getting those statements together is part marketing, part legal, and then you get it out and that's that. But Paizo took an extra couple of days to get their statement out intentionally to get as much feedback from anybody in the company that wanted to provide feedback on the statement and its purpose and its messaging as possible. And I really applaud that. I think for people outside the company, maybe they were on the attitude, it's like, why did this take so long? And some corporations that have been slow with their messaging are slow because they just kind of didn't get it at first, and they had to learn and be taught. With Paizo, it's because they really wanted to have internal voices have the ability to speak. And I really applaud that. It was great to see from the inside. And then we actually had the Friday of the march off. Black Lives Matter called for a general strike as well as the silent march. And it was just announced that this would be a day off, period, full stop. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, independently, yes, it is also the day when Black Lives Matter had been calling for a general strike and several Paizo people were down there for it. I suspect that, I told my boss, I'm not coming into work on Friday. And I suspect so many people did that they just said, well, you know, one thing we could do to show some solidarity here is just give everybody the day off.
Speaking of what's going on with Paizo, they also made another large announcement with Lisa Stevens stepping down. Can you talk about that at all?
I can talk a little bit. Our COO, Jeff Alvarez, has been a real sort of workhorse behind the scenes getting things done for the longest time. He's taken over a lot of the duties that Lisa has had over since I've arrived, you know, a couple of years ago anyway. And so it didn't seem unusual for him to slip into the president role. That I think on the ground, that's not going to be a lot of changes for me. I've had good interactions with him, although not many, frankly. He's a very busy guy, but I don't anticipate anything being a lot of serious changes the way Paizo works internally. I know externally, there's sort of a sense that Paizo itself consists of Lisa Stevens, Eric Mona, Jason Bowman, and James Jacobs, right? Those four people are the core of Paizo. And having one of those four people step aside is, I'm still on the board and still keeping an eye on things, but functionally stepping aside really sort of slims down the old guard that's the core of Paizo and make some of us that are newer feel like we've got a real ability to sort of make change and help with decisions and sort of step in. I like that.
So last episode, we had talked about various classes that both of us had played or liked to play and things like that. And this past week, I was working on a couple of new characters. And one of the things that I started thinking about as I'm working on these builds is actually party composition. So with me, I have 12 different characters that I use for society play. And basically, depending on what other people bring, I say, well, oh, okay, so we have a group that have all of these type of characters. I will bring something else to help fill the gap. And so one of the things I wanted to talk about is the type of composition or type of gaps that we oftentimes fill that aren't based on classes, but more based on roles.
Right. I think that there is there is some fantasy holdover from the idea that you need at least one fighter, wizard, thief, and cleric in your party. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's the case with Starfinder. If anything, there's a lot of successful adventuring that can be had with quite a mix. It's not so much the class as it is sort of the role that you take in the party.
Right, right. And so oftentimes when I'm looking at, you know, a group that, you know, people have signed up, I'll say, oh, there's a soldier, there's a Salarian, there's a Vanguard. To me, those are all frontliners, though they all could be, you know, ranged.
Right.
Ranged variants of that. But, you know, there's your sturdy guys. And I think, oh, but all those are pretty light on skills. Or maybe we have an operative there. We have somebody, but we don't have somebody to do diplomacy checks. Or we don't have somebody who can make mysticism checks. You know, looking at this balance of roles in combat, roles on starships, and then roles in skills situations is kind of how I look at party composition.
Yeah, I think that's good to keep an eye on. I, from an adventure designer perspective, I'm assuming that all that is taken care of, right? I'm not writing an adventure for a party of four Solarians, right? I am writing an adventure. Well, all right. I guess I am writing an adventure for a party of four Solarians who want to play on really hard mode. I am instead writing for somebody that's done a party that's done the same sort of calculation that you talk about. It's like, all right, well, let's make sure we've got, if not every skill covered, at least some of the skills we see a lot covered. And let's make sure we've got somebody that can stand toe to toe with a real melee combatant and people who can really dish out a lot of damage and so on and so on. For as much as fourth edition D&D is sort of reviled by some people, mm-hmm. One of the things I think they did really well is they divided all their classes up into very specific roles, into the striker, controller, leader, and defender. Mm-hmm. And if your party had one of each of those, it didn't matter whether you were a Scion or whether you were a wizard or whether if you fulfill those roles, you could expect to handle most things the game threw at you.
Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing about when we're looking at Starfinder in particular is that if you are doing an AP or you're doing a homebrew, so something where you have a regular group that's always getting together is going to play through an extended campaign, typically that group will come together and say, hey, here's the roles we need to get balanced out and figure out who's going to do what, who's going to cover what. Whereas if you're playing in society play, you don't know who's going to show up at the table. And especially at the low levels with new people, people have just the one character that they played. And so there's not a lot of options. You know, it's like, well, I have a mystic and that's what I got to play, even though there's three other mystics in the group. Now, the nice thing about a lot of scenarios in Starfinder in some of the APs is even if you have just one class or if you're limited and don't have something in a certain class, you can still be successful. And I won't say it's hard mode, but it is a little bit more challenging. In society play, you can actually get hirelings, which will help fill some of those gaps in terms of skill choices and stuff. But they don't really help in combat because your hirelings can't come into combat play.
Ah, I see. But you can cover any of the, if you need to hack into a computer panel or something, then mm-hmm. you can say, hey, hireling, to the front, get to work.
Yeah, it's very, very often, people talk about, they build a whole persona around their intern that comes in to help negotiate for them or,
grad student, yeah.
Yeah, or maybe it's their manager or it's their, their tech hacker that's in their ear kind of thing. So, which I think is actually kind of a neat way to do that. Now, in combat, that doesn't get covered, but when we look at combat, because you don't need a dedicated healer, really any mix of classes you have can get through things. Now, if you don't have anybody there that is comfortable going toe-to-toe in the front line, what I've seen happen is somebody's up front and then they retreat after their attack and the next person now is now up front and then they retreat after their attack. And so you have this kind of constant falling back until you've whittled down the enemy enough where people don't do that.
I see. So you're sort of spreading. There is a duty to go toe-to-toe with melee, but people spread that out if they don't have somebody that's specifically dedicated to that.
Right.
That sounds like a lot of smart play to me. I had some advice that really early on, I mean, when I was very first started writing for Paizo, it was talking to James Jacobs about high-level play and how people had claimed that high-level play starts to break down. He said, well, it's not, he says, I really push back against that, because if people are buying an adventure for 16th level characters and then building characters and running it, yes, it's going to seem kludgy and hard and difficult and your party dynamics don't work and so on. But if you've played all the characters from first to 15th level, by the time you get to 16th, your party has determined its balance so effectively that it's just smoothly rolls right into it. And I think there's a lot to be said for that, particularly when we did the 18th level playtest, where it's, okay, everybody take your 5th level characters, level them up to 18, and let's go. Mm-hmm. We had some really rocky parts that we all sort of realized. I think all of us around the table realized if we'd played these characters all the way up to 18th level, we wouldn't have these rocky parts. We'd have already figured all this stuff out.
Well, and that's actually part of the fun of growing a character, right? So, you know, when you first start, you have all these possibilities and all this potential. And I'll admit, I'm somebody who has diagrammed out how I want my character to go from first through 20th level, but I very rarely stick all the way to that. So, you know that things change. And then when you're playing with other people, you know, like in our current campaign, when you rolled out to GM with your operative, I brought in an operative. And one of the things that Rob, who plays Whiskey, asked is, well, Scooch was really good at survival and engineering. Are those things that you're going to be bringing? Or as we level up, are those things I need to work on? You know, so basically expecting that my character could fill different roles, and he was willing to pick up the slack on other parts that might be missing.
Yeah, and that's exactly why that sort of organic building, sort of the social contract, right, among players is we're not, instead of trying to one-up each other on who can be the highest, you know, KAC and EAC, or who's got the highest damage output, right? Instead, we're going to make choices to spread that around. One of the places I see that that's very interesting to me in a lot of groups is the division of items that people get, because sometimes it's, oh, you know, this character can make the best use out of this item. Let's give it to them. But the other times it's, hey, this item could shore up this weakness that we've seen this other character has. Maybe we give it to them. And the fact that that people talk that way in order to help create a stronger party, I think is really fun. It's one of the things I really enjoy about the game.
Well, and I noticed that every time we get loot with our group, you know, if it's clearly something that our vest soldier seems like would use, we're like, oh yeah, that'll go in that direction, you know, or if it's something that, you know, our operative would be better at, you know, so people recognize optimizing somewhat, but you're right. We did have a couple of our players that, you know, had low armor class. And so people were willing to make trade-offs. Well, this is great armor. I could use it. But, you know, so-and-so here hasn't had an armor upgrade for a couple levels. Maybe let's give them something there so that they're not as vulnerable in there. And again, when we're looking at party roles, oftentimes those backline folks, that your healers and mystics that you aren't expecting to be up in the forefront, might get shortchanged on some of those things that typically we're looking at for damage dealers and whatnot as well. So I think it's important that the party understands that.
Yeah, and I think the individual player's responsibility with that construction is to identify, hey, for myself, what am I really good at and what am I really lacking, right? If I don't think that anybody needs to know what everybody's reflex saving throw is, but I think if somebody is pointing out, you know, actually, when I'm looking at my saving throw, my reflex save is really terrible, like 5 points less than my other saves. That's awful. Then maybe it behooves getting one of the, you know, magic ring to supplement that and give it to the character or something.
Well, and especially in a campaign like an AP where you really get a finite number of item drops. You know, the treasure isn't coming all the time, isn't going to be evenly distributed, and you don't know when it's coming next, and you're not getting a lot of loot money that you can go and buy stuff with. I think it makes thinking about the best use of things for various party members pretty important.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. So I looking at party composition overall, I think as long as you don't have everybody doing the exact same thing, I think you can get by with most makeups of parties that you're going to get. You know, I've been in, like, I one of the, at PaizoCon like 3 years ago, I was in a mid-tier game, and we all had soldiers. And I thought it was going to be a lot of fun because we're just all going to go in there and bang heads and stuff. And, you know, with a lot of the scenarios that you have in society play, there's always about a third of them is some sort of skill challenge. So right. It's like, right. You know, and, but again, we recognize this. And so people brought hirelings, you know? So there's a way to compensate for it. Now, I do think that, it's not always fun to say, well, my hireling's just going to take care of that, and then not have somebody else being able to, you know, I hate being a soldier in a game where there's a lot of skill checks to be made, and basically I can't roll anything.
Oh, you know, I see. You've mentioned that before. You don't like that particular style of play where you've got you're the soldier and nothing else, right?
Right. Right. So, you know, to have some sort of balance there, I think becomes important.
Although I do want to call you out on a filthy lie, though. It wasn't PaizoCon 3 years ago. The game didn't exist 3 years ago. You mean three PaizoCons ago, including
three PaizoCons ago. Yes.
I think because one of the things that strikes me is this game is still so new, but still provides so much flexibility and so many options.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. And the new classes that came out in the COM, I've liked quite a bit. And, you know, I was talking to you offline. You know, I've made up a Vanguard to kind of see how that works. I've made up a biohacker now. And it's kind of neat to see the various roles that the biohacker can play, being able to do condition removal. You can heal stamina. You can heal hit points depending on the builds, which, I think in terms of roles, at the lower levels, you think of damage dealing and skills. At the higher levels, a lot of it ends up being condition mitigation because that's what ends up slowing down your party from doing things.
I think that's right. I had, and we talked about some of the other COM classes. I had a friend of mine who's doing a series of Witch Warper spells.
Oh.
And so was kicking back and forth with him about, I mean, just a, you know, sort of a minor side project, but he's talking about the Witch Warper spells, and I was able to talk to him about what's a Witch Warper really like? What types of magic really encompasses what a Witch Warper is? And I mean, just chatting about that one specific element got me even more excited about Witch Warpers. I mean, the thing that they do with the alternate realities and the overlay of realities is neat.
Well, yeah, and that's like, it's like in addition to, so they have spells and then they can give up a spell slot to do these unique abilities.
Yeah. Right? So alter the environment.
Right. And, yeah. So that's, it's kind of a neat mechanic. So that's like the next thing I'm going to make is a Witch Warper. And so I was trying to figure out how the mechanics of how that works. And again, what role it fits in the party. It's not like a technomancer where you're always casting stuff. You know, it's not like a mystic where maybe you have a primary healing role. It's more like crowd control or more support of a different sort. And again, trying to figure out how I would characterize that role, you know?
Yeah. Or maybe another way to think about it would be, what do people bring to the table that they don't have that makes you say, a Witch Warper is the right ad here? A Witch Warper is what's missing from this group.
Right. Boy, I wish we had a Witch Warper. Yeah, that kind of thing. And so because I'm not familiar enough with the class, that particular class yet, I don't really know. And so that's something, you know, I until I get a character and I build it up and play it some, I don't really understand the mechanics that well. And that's like the last one for me to get through.
All
so
right.
I wanted to move on to some questions we have from some various folks. And since we were talking about roles and different things, I think the first one I'll jump into is this one by Folklan, who asks, you know, there's 100 plus playable races at this point, and I think there's like over 119 now. So how do you kind of make distinctly different ones, even though if you might be the same species is kind of the question here. You know, for example, they give often you might have a dragonkin in there, and well, if you have two dragonkin, how do you kind of differentiate them? Do you give them different breath weapons or things like natural weapons, stuff like that? What's your thoughts on having building different characters of the same species?
Well, this is a let me try to give a non-answer there that is leading into what I think is the key answer. I've got a character that I just made for a campaign who had been raised with a family of sort of chefs for the sort of out of the way manner. And these space pirates had come through in order to raid the place. And while still a kid, this character joined up with the space pirates. And then they became like this scourge of the diaspora, right? And nobody wanted anything to do with these pirates. It got more and more powerful until eventually my character's like, you know what? I'm not really with these guys. I don't like what they do. And it's great to have this sort of, you know, pirate training, but I've got to slip out. So this character slips out and is sort of on the run from these pirates and starting an adventuring career, knowing that these pirates are out there and probably want this character either brought back to a life that he doesn't want to live in or killed for the secrets that he must know. And that's part of the backstory. And that is a very distinctive character. And nowhere in there did I tell you the character's race, right? That mm-hmm, could be mm-hmm. any character, that could be any race given a background like that, and it's going to be very different from the same. Maybe that was a dwarf, right? Maybe that was a Sheeran of some kind. Maybe that was just some race pulled out of Alien Archive 3, and it's going to be so different than somebody with the same mechanical entry playing a character. I think the answer is, it's a sort of a long way around of saying, I think it's in the story that you build and the stories that you tell with the characters is where the real differences start to shine.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think in addition to that, though, Starfinder gives you alternative character traits that you can use. And so, for example, I was making a biohacker, and at the time when I was making this character, I wasn't sure if it was going to be a mystic or what it was going to be, but I knew the name of the character I wanted. And I have a really weird way of making characters. And so I thought of, I wanted to make a mystic originally, and I think I'll make him a dwarf because the basic dwarf bonuses are to wisdom and constitution. That'll be good for a dwarf. And so I thought of this name. Okay, he's going to be Garth Algar. For those of you that aren't old enough to know, that's a fictional movie character that I happen to like quite a bit. I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
So if you're from Illinois, hopefully you're familiar with that.
Oh yes. Oh yes.
So anyway, so I decided, okay, I'm going to make this mystic named Garth Algar, and it'll be a lot of fun. And then I start thinking, oh, I'm going to make this a biohacker instead. Well, I wanted to make it a studious biohacker whose main traits are intelligence and dexterity. And so it's like, well, that doesn't work for a dwarf, but I have this great name. Oh, what am I going to do? Well, it turns out that there's an alternative trait set you can use for a dwarf. My dwarf happened to be raised in a place called Salvation's End. He was raised, I don't want to give away too many spoilers. He was raised in a simulation that came from a society scenario. And basically, because of that, he has different characteristics than your traditional dwarf. And so that's part of his backstory that I build up. So in addition to having a unique backstory, different than maybe other dwarves, he also has these different traits that kind of go along with it. So we might have two dwarves in the party, and we're completely different makeup, and we do completely different kind of things.
Yeah, you're going to be nothing like any other dwarf that anybody else creates.
Oh, Garth is not. Yeah, exactly.
And that's where the real difference comes in. I think that there is something to be said for the importance of what somebody actually does during combat round three and how their dice hit the table. But that is only one, you know, and sometimes small aspect of the game. It's how the character approaches difficulties, interacts with other players, interacts with NPCs. I mean, that's just as much part of the character, and that's very much part of the realm of imagination and making the character up.
Oh, I think so. I mentioned in the last episode I was making my Vanguard, so I got him finished. I actually got a chance to play him, and Leroy Jenkins has a lot of fun. Just saying. As a Vanguard, man, he can wade in there and take them all on, and nothing happens. And I decided, you know, he's going to have his he's actually a trained as a chef as well, so he gets to have his chicken. So
I do wonder whether or not you'll come across any other group that you play with that who don't know what naming your character Leroy Jenkins means you're going to be playing your character like. Right, you go rushing into a room, they're like, man, why on earth would you do that? You're like, well, it's in my name. What?
Yeah.
What? I mean,
right. Well, and so I played with some folks that were not all from my local group. So there were some folks, we have a local group, and when all positions aren't filled, we invite some folks for Warhorn. So there's a couple of people in there, and I tell them, look, my name is Leroy Jenkins. You should know how I'm going to play this, forewarning you. So there's, oh, great, that'll be fun, you know, and so... All right, so we have another question from Gina B., who actually asked a lot of questions last time as well. This is kind of concerns the science fantasy setting, and basically it seems that science really steals the show in Starfinder, and that there's not a lot of fantasy-specific things, or you know, you only can have like two magic items. Magic doesn't seem as strong. So how can you, if you're really into the fantasy part of the science fantasy, how do you flesh that out? How do you bring it out?
I assume that's a question that sort of as a GM, how do you bring that out? Because with a player, you're playing within the realm that is established by the story or the adventure path or something like that. So I don't know what you can do if you're in the middle of a hard science fiction story and you really want to be fantastical. But if you're a GM, then the game has got a lot of tools to be able to lean more fantasy. I don't think it's got enough tools to be strictly fantasy the way that some science fiction stories can be. But I think that it certainly is enough to lean in the direction of more fantasy. And Paizo's Adventure Paths will do that. They've said that Dawn of Flame is our most fantasy type of science fantasy, and playing in it still feels very techie.
Well, and I think a lot of it is the nature of how the players approach the problems. You know, we have a mystic in our group, but everybody, and we have a Solarian, but everybody really is pretty straightforward, kind of like, let's noodle something out, let's figure it out, let's science something out. It's not like they're looking for a big mystical connection on anything, which it turns out, spoilers, that there is.
Yeah.
In this, you know, in this particular, as we're finding now in our, this latest episode we're getting into, actually. So, yeah, it's, I think the game itself, the setting that you're given allows for it, but it's how players and GMs decide that they want to have things play out. You can build a highly magical character. So in one of my groups right now, I have a player who's a technophobe, right? And only magic and all technology is that's just blasphemy and refuses to touch it and do stuff. And only magic is good. And well, the character I'm playing is an engineer and I'm all tech. And so we have a lot of fun going back and forth with this, I'm about the technology and this is how we'll solve this. No, that's evil. You can't do this, you know? And so it actually makes it a lot of fun, but again, it's because he's chosen to play that way, you know, to make it much more from his perspective to be much, everything is about magic and that's what drives the world. That's what's important. Now, you know, that said, we don't have these big, super powerful magic items. We, you know, the spell levels only go up to 6th level, so you don't have these big earth-shattering spells typically for doing things. You don't see magic users that completely dominate the world, you know, evil, you know, Sauron types that can do everything. So, you know, it is, I think, heavily skewed towards the science part.
Right. I think that you've got some things you could do to make it feel more magical within your own game. One of the things that will, a simple change that actually has some pretty powerful ramifications that will push the magic in your game, the gas pedal down to the floor, is if you said that you've got as far as spellcasting goes, if you're a spellcaster, then you either have no limit on the spell slots that you can cast, mm-hmm. or some extraordinarily high limit. So if you're telling people, if you're a spellcaster, you get third level. Once you get third level spells, you can cast those third level spells all day long. Then mm-hmm. people are going to. I mean, initially you're like, "Wow, that's incredibly powerful, right?" But if you're sparse in giving out the technology, then suddenly mm-hmm. people have to rely on the cosmic eddies and the spells in order to do damage. And then they build their lower level spells to be all the utility types of things,
right?
Disguise self and see invisibility. So the things that they might otherwise have tech use. So that would be a fairly straightforward way to key a Starfinder campaign to be primarily about the magic and encourage mm-hmm. people to kind of leave the tech behind.
You know, I was actually thinking about that when I was reading this question about how you could boost magic users. Because one of the things I don't like about magic in Starfinder and it's the same with Pathfinder and other games, where you have this limited usage of a lot of spells. Now, there are ways to get around that in Starfinder with spell caches and spell chips, where basically you can use money and technology and buy more slots, right?
Right, right.
But I was thinking, like, kind of along the lines you were talking about is, why don't we have a mana pool, right? We have a stamina pool. We have a health pool. Why not have a mana pool like you see in a lot of other games, where it drains down over, you know, so say every, this is what I thought of anyway. Mm-hmm. So say you have your level plus your ability mod is your mana pool. That's how many spell slot total that you can have, and it drains down and refills after a 10-minute rest, basically. Right. So instead of having to go all day, now at lower levels, right? So at first level, you'd only have maybe 4 points. Well, you might have 4 first level spells you can cast. Okay. So that's pretty good. Then 10-minute rest, you get them back. As you get higher level, you know, that would scale as well. And if you wanted to adjust that, then you could say, oh, you know what? Not only this, but every minute you start getting one of these things back. So if you're an extended encounter, so in 10 rounds, your things start coming back. So in a longer battle, your wizard isn't just back there taking pot shots with a pistol. He actually gets, or she gets, more spells.
Some of the capability. And in some cases, that might be change of tactics to be, all right, let's hold things off for one more round.
Right.
Because I'm going to get that spell back, and then everything's going to be awesome.
Right. And so that's, you know, I was thinking about that. That would encourage me to play magic user a lot more. Yeah. So now that said, you know, like I have a mystic who has quite a few spell slots and other abilities. So you're not just about, you know, casting damage, dealing spells and stuff, but it's like, if you could have more of those, but then you get to balance out how powerful the spells are, because obviously if you can do a super powerful spell more frequently, then that really boosts some parts that you would have to probably cut down a little bit, but anyway.
Right, right. But there are ways to design your campaign,
yeah,
even with some fairly minor tweaks. I mean, I think any of the tweaks that we've talked about could be explained in less than a paragraph.
Right, yeah. So, I think you could do that in two sentences, and people would get it. And I don't know, mechanically, is it leveled up? I did some calculations up to like 12th level. It seemed about similar to what you would have now. I don't know how that would. I think it slows down in scale because you don't get the ability score upgrades as much after a certain point, right?
I see what you mean.
Yeah, so you might have to like double your level or something like that.
Yeah, and that could be a class feature too. You could give some customizability that way. Anyway, all right, we don't need to design a whole new magic campaign structure here.
All right, so we have one last question I want to touch on. Well, we have a couple of minutes here. So Ryan asks that he's sure that poisons, diseases are particularly deadly in Starfinder, and people have questioned if it's true to the science fantasy source material that the game emulates. That is, should these things be so deadly? We've talked about this a little bit, and I think they're a little more complicated than just straight out damage, but I don't think they're any more deadly than anything else in the game.
Yeah, I was initially surprised that a lot of the poisons will skip past however many stamina you have and go mm-hmm. right into your hit points. And ooh, isn't that
right?
You know, isn't that serious? Oh, actually, it's not very serious, especially having played with it. You know, seeing it at the table a few times. Like, well, it's actually kind of makes the mystic or whoever the healer is gives them kind mm-hmm. of something to do, right? Where they otherwise might not have something to do. If you're down into hit points, you still got all your stamina points. So I don't think that they tend to be particularly debilitating. And I think that radiation even less so, because wearing any kind of armor gives you some defense right. against radiation up to total immunity when you're sort of dealing with lesser levels of radiation. So I think that the actual impact of radiation I've seen in play tends to be small.
Well, I think at lower levels, what you typically see with poisons and disease is that it does a little bit of hit point damage, usually less than a D6, and then it'll have some minor inconvenience effects if you're constantly failing your saves.
Like on the tracks, you advance.
On the track, right. As you get to a higher level, those inconveniences become much more substantial. And if you advance on the track, so say you, for some of them, you know, if you fail four saves, you're dead, you know. Okay. And so that's a pretty substantial thing. Now, other people can aid you in making those saves. So that's another particular issue.
And there's technological pieces right. that can help you with those saves as well. They're tech solutions mm-hmm. to a lot of that.
Yeah, so it's not, I think the fact that it goes straight to hit points, I was like with you, oh, this is scary, wow. But it happens at one time, right? And then you're on the track, and it's not, it's like, oh, well, maybe some of the tracks affectability scores. Well, that's kind of a big deal, because then somehow you're going to get restored on that. Some of the tracks, you know, give, you know, some debilitation. Well, that's going to be a minor irritation, gets to be a little bit more major, and can be a problem. But again, this is, I think, as I started at the beginning of this, party composition, I think as you get higher level, having somebody who can help make those saves and deal with those conditions and afflictions becomes much more important as these things get more serious. And at the lower level, even though it goes against hit points, I don't think any of them are particularly deadly.
Yeah, I think that's right. But I do, as far as Ryan's question goes, I think that emulates the genre really well, because science fiction is often about, oh, you've been given this terrible, debilitating thing that we in the real world are afraid of. Oh, well, pop this pill or take this injection and you're fine. You know, oh, mm-hmm. here's a, put you on this flatbed scanner over you. Okay, we have discovered and eradicated all your cancer, right? That's mm-hmm. science fiction-y. And so I think that having technological and magical, because it's science fantasy, tools mm-hmm. that allow you to eliminate these debilitating conditions we've been talking about actually fits the genre very well. It feels like it's a good fit to me.
I also think it's important to have something that's going to make the player nervous. You know, if I'm taking damage and I know, you know, it's going to take four hits to get through my stamina points to get to my hit points, I'm not particularly worried about it. But if I'm taking poison or radiation or disease that possibly is going to get right to my hit points right away, I have a little bit more concern about it. Now, I'm not super concerned about it, but initially it's like I do have quite a bit. And I think being able to instill some differential concern for the player other than, oh, here's a new monster beating on you, I think adds quite a bit to the game.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so too. I think that the more tools that a GM has or an adventure writer has to put the heroes sort of back on their heels a little bit and get them really thinking about what they do and how they address the situations is just really good for the game.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I think that's our time for this week. I'm hoping that I'm well enough to do our next one and we don't skip a week, but I'm not betting on it right now. So just right. So you know.
I also yeah. hope that, but I want to make sure that you're prioritizing your health and your recovery.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I'm hoping I'm just bored out of my gourd and I'm just, oh man, just give me something to do and we'll come up with something wonderful. And so hopefully we'll be on track. Otherwise, we might skip. We might have to do a best of. Or no, we don't have enough for a best of.
Best of six. Every one of ours is a shining jewel, Todd, and none are yes. better than any other. We have kids. We know how to talk like this. We love you all the same, but for different reasons. Anyway.
All right. So with that, I'm John.
And I'm Ron, and this is Digital Divination.